I'm Bailey Parnell, and this is Let's Think This Through. Join me for drinks as I bring on guests for conversations that inspire, amuse, and challenge us, but in a fun and relaxing kind of way. Ultimately, it's to help us all learn and live a better, easier life. So let's think this through. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Let's Think This Through with me, Bailey Parnell. You are in for a treat today with today's guests. And normally I record this intro ahead of time, but I recorded it afterwards. So I know for sure that you are in for a treat because this next guest I actually met in Saudi Arabia, of all places. We were at the SYNC Digital Wellbeing Summit. It was the first time that people working in digital wellbeing really had been collected globally in that way. And when she spoke, this powerful woman, PhD, CEO of a consulting firm, she really riled me up. I love what she said. I loved that I could sense this activist spirit in her, wanting the best for the people. And so we met up again when I went to Spain for the first time, which is where she is from. We learned that we were both moving to New York at the same time. So we went through that process together as well. And we've since met up here where she lives in Harlem. But like I said, I'm recording this after, so I know that we had a lot of fun on this podcast. She introduced me to some Spanish wines, and we bring back a margarita, and we really get into everything from her work and what it's like to be a CEO of an AI algorithmic consulting firm right now. And we even talk personal stuff, and I hope that you enjoy it because today I am having drinks with Dr. Gemma Galdon-Clavel. Welcome, Gemma.
Thank you.
I'm so glad to have you on the podcast. You are definitely somebody I would be thinking things through with whenever I see you.
Yeah, definitely.
What are you drinking over there this evening?
I'm drinking my favorite drink of all drinks, a margarita.
And just for you, I also brought a margarita, but this might be a little blasphemous. It's vodka-based.
Oh, it looks so fancy. Like mine is just out of a can.
So that's because you are a real margarita drinker. You're such a real drinker that you're like, I don't need to make it fancy. I, on the other hand, I needed to show up for you.
No, but I spent so much time when I first got here trying to find a margarita in a can that tastes better than regular margaritas that does in a can, that I'm just like, you know, I'm super happy with the taste of this one. It doesn't need anything other than ice.
It is wild the way that like cocktails in a can really blew up, at least for me, in the pandemic. That's when it really got big. Yeah.
Oh, interesting. You was know, when I first moved to the US when I was 19, I fell in love with wine coolers. That my husband had to buy because I couldn't buy them. But I was just like, and now they're so hard to find. But I was like, I don't like beers. So like anything alcoholic and sweet is like my thing to go.
Yeah. Well, it's so funny because when I was, so I grew up in Canada, a little lower of a drinking age than the US. We're at like 18, 19 across the country. But it's fine. I think a lot of young people start off with like wine coolers and those sweeter drinks. And but then when the pandemic started, at least for us, there was not that many options for cocktails that were pre-made. But then because all the local bars were kind of looking for ways to sell things, they actually put like really good time and effort into it. And then they just continued selling it after. And I was very happy.
Well, you know, one of the things that I've noticed, like in Spain, we drink a lot of wine. And so that's what we always do. And then, and it's also very cheap. And then you come here and the thought of a glass of wine costing the same as a cocktail, like in Spain, cocktails are really expensive. Wine is really cheap. And so you're like, you know, I might as well get the cocktail. So I'm having a lot more cocktails since I moved here, just because I'm like, you know, if I'm going to pay $15 for wine, I might as well experiment with this new thing.
Yeah. Well, I mean, moving here is definitely one of the things I was looking forward to catching up with you about, because when we first met, that was one of the things we realized was that we were both moving to America around the same time, which would have been summer of 2022.
Yes.
So tell everyone, why did you move here from Spain? And for everyone listening, we are both based in New York City now.
Mm-hmm. So I moved here because I had been leading a nonprofit working on algorithmic fairness and AI justice. And I felt like Europe, there was like a bit of a ceiling. Oh, I have a guest here. You may have seen.
That's all right. We can think through with anybody. You're welcome to join the margarita party, little cat.
No, he's not going to drink margarita. That's like, I draw a line there.
Keep it safe.
So I'd been running for, back then it was 10 years, a nonprofit working on AI justice. And I felt like Europe didn't offer the opportunities that we needed because it was becoming such a hot topic. And I felt that no matter what we did, the ceiling in terms of funding, in terms of impact was just very low. And so, and my husband had been asking for a sabbatical for a long time. So I thought, let's just go to the US. Let's just give it a go, you know? I would always say like, I'm going to the US in the same way that the Faraonas, you know, like the flamenco dancers in the 1920s went to the US. Like, you know, I'm going there to like, to seek opportunities. Like in Spanish, we say, triunfar, you know, I'm going there to make it.
And it was like
half joking, but yeah, I think like whoever comes here, especially in New York, I think we all come with this idea, like, you know, what will this city and this country do to me? And it's been a really wild ride. Like I came here less than 2 years ago. I'm leading a nonprofit and now I'm the CEO at a software startup that works on AI bias. So like the possibilities that I've had since moving here and the possibilities that have opened up for me, I don't think any of that would have happened in Spain. So I'm really, really happy that we came. And I'm also really, really happy that I made a mistake when I applied for my visa. And when I was thinking that I was applying for a 2-year visa.
Yeah.
And my husband got a 2-year break at his job. And then at some point down the line, I realized that actually I had applied for a green card.
Oh my God.
And I got it.
Lucky you. You know,
we were coming for 2 years and it's like, well, now apparently they're going to give us green cards. So yeah, we're going to stay actually today. Like I'm really, really celebrating today. Oh. We closed on an apartment in New York.
Like, so hey, cheers.
We bought a place here. So,
okay. I'll cheers you for real. Yeah.
Yeah. So we're staying here for,
oh my
for
gosh,
some time.
That is awesome. And you know what? They do not make it easy. They don't.
Oh, no.
I mean,
no.
I wish I had talked to you, like knew you earlier in this whole process for me, because I remember you taught me like a year too late that I should have done the EB process instead of the O-1 process because that has a green card track. And I was, so now I'm going to have to change my status from O-1 at some point to a green card through marriage. So that's
yeah, and basically do it all over again. Like I did it once in 9 months. I had a green card. Like, yeah, I think there's a lot of myth around EB1As just because it's like, you know, the Einstein visa for people of extraordinary ability. And it is true that the requirements are quite like demanding. But it's also
true, but
if you work in a field and you're kind of relatively prominent in your space, it's quite easy to fulfill the requirements. Like, you know, if you have media exposure in your country, if you've advised governments, like it just, when I read the conditions, I was like, I totally fulfill these conditions. So I'm just going to give it a go.
Oh, for sure. And you know, it's like we joked, it's more like, it's like writing a dissertation about yourself. Like, why are you cool?
Yes, 187 pages mine was. Oh, and apparently that's short. Like afterwards, I learned that people were like 500 pages. I'm like, I felt mine was just so heavy. Also, an interesting thing, I applied from Spain, but I could only pay with a US card. And I could only track my package and make sure that it arrived quickly if it was sent from the US. And so I got a friend of mine to print everything from DC and send it and pay with her credit card because it had to be a US card and I didn't have a US account back then. So it's like, you know, these 127 pages like traveling around the world and being printed and reprinted in really far away places. So it was like, it was a big journey, but I'm just so happy that we got into it and let's see, like we don't know what's going to happen, but I know that it's been worthwhile.
Oh, I mean, I've lucked out that even I got to see you too, and you're in Harlem, and I know that my husband and I both enjoy Harlem too. So we'll see what us holds in the future. But on that note, let's do like a better and worse, because I'm also not from the US, I'm from Canada. And so, but there are things that brought us here that we love, and there are things that are not as great here. So let's end positively. So let's start with what is not better here. Like, what are you like, I could use that back in Spain again?
The price of wine. Like, it's just crazy. Like, and also the fact that the financial requirements of going out are so high that I feel that a lot of people are left out. And that's something that I'm not comfortable with. Like, I come from a country where going out and getting a drink with or without alcohol is something that everyone can do. And so the street and the cafeterias and the bars are very much used by lots of different people. Here, I think that I'm lucky that I'm in West Harlem, which is a very diverse community. But even here, you can see how the people that have the privilege to walk into a place where you have to pay to drink or eat, there's like a massive division line between the haves and the have-nots. So I feel that a lot more here, and I feel that socialization has this kind of glass line that it's just weird. It's weird to me, and I don't really appreciate it. So that's such a good main thing.
Such a good observation. I'm from Canada, of course, which is a lot more similar to US than Spain is. And I wouldn't have thought about that as much, because it's like probably more similar in that when you go out and you're going anywhere, it is closer prices to where we are here. Although nothing is as bad as New York. Right. Good Lord,
yeah.
I tell you.
Yeah. But also I think that I come from a very like also not normal country. I think Spain is so cheap. Like we really enjoy going out. There's bars and cafeterias everywhere and restaurants. So it's just very, very easy and very affordable.
Mm-hmm. And would you say that's one of the differences between, I guess, now expanding beyond Spain and the US, like European culture and North American culture? Like, is that one of the major differences that you've noticed?
I think a big difference is that things are less about money in Europe. In the US, everything's about money. And everything's measured through and by money. And that's kind of like very obvious in your day-to-day life. Like cars, like how much people invest in their cars, for instance, in their homes. Like, you know, the showing off. I think that in Europe, that's less important. And I think that we show off in different ways. Again, like not saying that it's better or worse, but it is something that I clearly see a difference. Like here, you're very much judged by who you are, how much you make, where do you work. In Europe, the question, like, you know, where do you work? Like no one really cares. That's not what makes you, which it's weird because it's very much what makes me. Like I love my job. I'm really passionate. So I feel like I fit in better here. But I can totally see a difference. Like in Europe, people may appreciate what I do, but it doesn't define me. They don't judge me based on that. Here, it's my door to everything and everyone.
So what would, over there, what would be considered like the thing that makes you cool?
Just being like, I was going to say being nice, not being nice, just having a connection at a personal level, like regardless of who you are, like I'm having fun with you, which is said something to make me laugh. So like you connect at that level, not based on achievements.
Well, doesn't that sound nicer? I mean, that you've actually got to be like an impressive socializer, that you like you've actually got to care about relationships, and that will make you stand out. You know, that's what it sounds like.
Yes.
Okay. Sure. So what is something then that you would think is better here? And I think I've already kind of heard a few, but I want to hear from you. Like, what's better in America?
Like on a day-to-day basis, like I love how extroverted people are here. Like I'm an extroverted introvert, if that makes any sense. Like I'm there's lots of things about me that I don't like to share, and I have my own ways. But at the same time, like I love talking to people. I love like if I'm going out, just if I see something that is interesting, like I love getting to know people on a superficial level, but just striking conversations. And I love how people welcome that here. and do it all the time. I think my husband's a bit like ashamed of me because I'm so like, you know, just strike conversations. And he's like very Spanish, like, what are you doing? But we've met, like we've had such amazing evenings just because I start talking to people and people don't look at you weird. Like in Spain, they would look at you really weird if you just try to have a conversation with someone. It's like, you know, what do you want? And here, that's not the case. You know, it's funny because the first week we were here, we went to Whole Foods and I heard a couple with a kid speaking Spanish from Spain. And I was like, oh, they're Spanish and they're in our neighborhood because they're coming. They're going to the local supermarket. And so I kind of waited for them. And my husband was like, no, don't talk to them. Don't talk to them. And I'm like, but they're Spanish. And so I went up to them and I was like, hi, how are you? And they introduced themselves. And it was so obvious that they did not want to be having that conversation with me.
They're probably like, who are you?
Yeah, like another Spanish person, like we're not interested. And I was like, So, you know, it just doesn't work on Spanish people. We're not like that. I think we're a lot more aware of ourselves and a bit more stiff. Yeah. So I really like about here. And this idea of opportunity that I don't know if it's true. Like I certainly see a lot of people struggling here as well. I also think that New York is very much an island in the US. Like the level of social protection that we have here is not what you find in most large cities in the US. But it does have this thing of, yeah, like things can happen to you that would not happen elsewhere in the world.
I feel that completely. I mean, I go to, you know, a random event and the folks that are sitting beside you are like, it's bizarre. This global organization and that one and this researcher. And it's like, oh yeah. But I always feel a kinship with people that moved to New York immediately. And I think even like the people I meet on the street, honestly, most of them are not from here. And I automatically know it's like, you chose here for some reason. So we share something in common.
Totally.
So then in the world of tech, what are the differences there? Because, you know, culture is one thing, but like you are really embedded in tech and you've been advising government. So like, how does that world change from what's happening in Europe to North America?
Oh, so many levels. So one of the reasons why I came here was because we were really well established, and I was really well established in Europe at the policy making space. But I felt that Europe was all about blah, 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 and like the laws and the principles, which are really important, don't get me wrong.
But the
real things need to be discussed at the specific level. Like it's, you know, yes, we want AI to be better. What does better mean? Yes, we want AI to not discriminate. What does non-discrimination mean? How do we protect vulnerable populations? Like we had like the what, but no one was talking about the how. And I've always been like a problem solver. So I was not comfortable staying at this high level principle space, but also like we have been talking about that for like 15 years. I'm like, how more can we talk about the principles? Like we know the principles. We know that it's, you know, fairness, non-discrimination, accountability, explainability. We know that. Now, how do we do that? And I felt that in the US, the focus was not so much on policy, but on practices. So I was like, well, with my knowledge of policies and the focus in the US on practices, I think that I can really bring something new to the table that is going to be welcome. Like I felt that in Europe when I was like getting into metrics and benchmarks and being super technical, people were like not interested. They just, they didn't find it relevant. And here, because they're talking about the specific things, the legal and the policy background actually makes sense. So I feel more useful here than I did in Europe. But at the same time, no one knows me here. Like, you know, I start from the very, very bottom. Like I feel like I know a lot, but whenever I go to an event, it's like, you know, hi, I think I have something interesting to say. And people look at me like, you know, where do you come from? Because again, you start from scratch and you have to build your reputation from zero, which is, it's hard, but it's also like, it's part of the price that you pay. And it's also humbling. So I'm like, I'm not, you know, I actually welcome the change. I hope that, you know, in a few months things are going to get less difficult at that level. But it's a nice change. So like, yeah, the the fact that things are a lot more concrete and we're talking about real things is something that I really, really welcome. There's also a lot more money here and the decisions are made here. And so what I found in Europe is that even if we were talking to the big tech companies, they were not the departments that were making decisions. Like, you know, the HQs were always in the US. So you never had actual access to decision makers. So you may seduce and convince a bunch of people from a large big tech in Europe, but that it ends there.
So I can see that completely.
It's a lot more useful.
It reminds me of when I used to work in media, and I worked at a big Canadian media organization, and I worked for some of the sub brands like Much Music, MTV, and E3, all networks that exist in the US as well. But I'll never forget, I worked on a team of four people and I was just a part-time contractor at that time. And we all four of us worked on four brands for all of Canada. And MTV US alone at that time, because we were social marketing, had 15 full-timers just dedicated to MTV US social media. And we couldn't make decisions at all similarly without having gone to US counterparts. So had I stayed in that field, I know I would have had to end up here at some point for sure.
Exactly.
But what I love about you and your work too, and it sounds like it comes from that, I don't know actually where it comes from, is this gusto, like that inner activist in you comes out even in the way that you're describing, like what you like about here and what you like about there. And like, where does that come from? Where does the inner activist come from?
Oh, so many places. You want to get personal, like family history 100%. And stuff?
100%.
My grandparents were anarchists. They fought in the Spanish Civil War, and they had to go into exile. So I was born and raised in a family of refugees, returned refugees, which was very, very traumatic. But I grew up with all that trauma of having gone through a civil war, being expelled from your country, being stripped of your citizenship while being in exile initially in Paris, then in other countries. But at the same time, my granddad never lost his beliefs. So he would teach me Esperanto when I was little and tell me about a world, you know, a future when we'd all be equals and brothers and sisters. So I grew up with those ideals. Oh. But then also my mom had me at 14. And that was really hard. Back then in Spain, basically, children like me would end up being stolen and being given to rich families. And for some reason, my dad insisted on having me and keeping me, even though they did have offers to send me to a convent that then would become that. But just being born into a dysfunctional family, I would say, and a family that didn't have things easy, that didn't have a clear place in the world, also made me very aware of how hard it is for many of us to fit in and to follow a path, because there's no path for us. And if there is one, it's not a good one. And so when I started working on tech, I'm like, I've always felt my whole life I've been beating the odds. Like, you know, I was not supposed to go to university. I was not supposed to have a successful career. I was not supposed to have a stable mental life. I was not supposed to be married to a very nice person. Like, so many of the things that happened to me, I was not supposed to get it. And I've just been beating the odds. And that's what AI is. Like, AI are just odds at scale. And I feel that I've been able to beat the odds because no one imposed my odds on me. No one said, you know, your chances are very low. And so I really didn't know. I just kept going. Wow. And I just managed to get out of a space where I was supposed to be. And now that I'm older and I see what happened to other people in my family, I realize what a trap that was and how easy it would have been for me to kind of fulfill the prophecy of who I was to be. And I just don't appreciate that AI kind of puts us in these boxes where, you know, your chances are low, therefore why invest in you? And I fear that unless we work on building better AI will not be a tool for liberation, but a tool for making sure that people with low odds never give a go at beating the odds, right? And I want to defend the right of every little kid like me who was born under unusual circumstances to yep. think that they can be whatever they want to be, regardless of the odds. And for me, it's so fascinating coming to the U.S. because this country has been built so much on this idea of beating the odds.
So true.
And then when we have the tech debate, no one thinks about that. You know, what does it mean to predict things? Well, predict things means that you box people and facts and futures. This country is about not predicting, is about giving everyone a chance, regardless of your data, regardless of your past. So I want to make sure that we keep that because I think that it's important.
I know. I think that, you know, I don't even know where this came up last, but maybe on the last episode, but I recently in January read the initial documents, what they call the documents of freedom in the U.S., the U.S. Constitution and what Bill of Rights and whatnot. And I actually thought they were quite impressive documents and honestly don't need to be changed that much, but just need to be upheld more, mm-hmm. you know? Yeah. But I just love how you're saying like, hey, somebody needs to think, and you know, I know that you and I are, but someone needs to think about how this technology that we create either supports and liberates human rights or detracts from it. And now, how do you explain the importance of technology ethics and human rights to someone who might not be so familiar with tech or with activism? Because I know they're listening right now.
Right. Well, I think it's fairly easy. Like, of course, very obvious to me, but yeah. It's like, so AI is basically like the all AI works in the same way. It's large data sets with data from the past. And then AI systems that extract patterns from that data and come to the conclusion that the majority, like the thing that most people do is the best thing to do. Let me just put an example. Mm. So like your GPS, like one of the AIs that we interact with on a daily basis is GPS, asking like, how do I get from A to B? The way that works is there's information on how people have moved in a geographical area from the past. So we know how people have moved. And then the AI system is trained on saying, okay, so if you want to go from A to B, how have most people gone from A to B in the past? And AI just assumes that if most people made that choice, there must be a reason for that. And so it would suggest that you make the same choice. And that's great when you're talking about GPS or where you're getting like a recommendation on Netflix or Spotify. Like, you know, most people after listening to this song, listen to these other songs. So because most people did that, you may also want to do that. In GPS, in recommender systems, in culture or leisure, that's absolutely fine. But what happens when you use the same logic and the same data dynamic to decide who gets a mortgage or a loan at a bank? So you have training data from the past. So who were our clients in the past and who were most of our clients and who were our best clients? Because women have been excluded from having access to formal jobs for a long time. In many countries in Europe until 1970-something, you still needed the signature of your husband to open a bank account. So, like, you know, there's recent history that says that we've been underrepresented as clients of the banking system, and we continue to be. We make less money. Men tend to continue to play the financially active role in the family. Mm-hmm. And so if we apply the same GPS logic, what the AI system is going to say is the best client we've had in the past is a white man with a stable job. Mm-hmm. And so what happens is that in a GPS, it makes sense that if most people go from A to B following X route, that you understand that whoever took a different route is an outlier and you want to kind of ignore them because it's like, you know, maybe they had to stop and buy something or, you know, it's like they didn't make the most efficient decision. But when you use that in high risk environments, in banking, in hiring, et cetera, what we're basically saying is whoever is not a white man with a stable job, we don't want them as clients. And so in an AI system, as a woman or as a non-majority group, as a non-pattern group, you start by being discriminated against and you end up disappearing because you become like the equivalent of an inefficient route for the bank to take or for a company to decide to hire you. And that's really, really problematic. Like, and the good thing is that we can solve that. We can fix that. Like, you know, even with GPS, we know that if there's an accident, that idea of, you know, data from the past takes prevalence over everything, we know that that's not the case. And so we can incorporate rules in the algorithm. So if there's an accident and a change in the pattern in the last 20 minutes, then that takes precedence over historical data. But the efforts that we're making in GPS, we're not making them in high-risk environments. And so we are seeing AI
being like a mortgage?
Mortgage, or again, hiring, or medical diagnosis, or medical prioritization and triage. We have so many AI systems making decisions, and no one's caring about the outliers. No one's caring and protecting the groups that are not the patterns identified by AI. And that is a human mistake. Like, we have not paid enough attention to this. And so the systems that we are deploying are of really bad quality, but also very problematic and very dangerous for those of us who are not a white man with a stable job.
Wow. So then where in healthcare would be an example of like how this is probably affecting us?
We have evidence of if you are a Black woman, your chances of a computer system used by the hospital to suggest that you have a C-section instead of a natural birth are higher.
Oh.
While having the same medical circumstances, just because you're Black and because in the past, Black women have been forced into C-sections more than white women. There's been audits. What we do at Ethicus AI is audit AI systems precisely to identify these issues. There's been audits in triage systems in the US that found that the AI systems that determine how long you had to wait at the emergency room had been trained on financial data and not medical data. And so you were being rushed through the emergency room, not based on how urgent care was, but how expensive it may be, which is just crazy, because that means that if you went to the emergency room with symptoms for cancer, you were rushed in because it's a really expensive disease. But if you went in with a heart attack, which can be relatively easy to fix and solve, you were like being told, oh, you have to wait, which is like, that makes no medical sense. And so again, the choices that we make with the data are so crucial and are so important. And what we see when we audit is a lot of decisions are being badly made, and there's no oversight over that. And so we end up being victims of really problematic systems. There's now, there was a case a few years ago in the UK Postal Service where they incorporated AI to identify whether postal workers were committing fraud. And several workers were identified as criminals. They were fired. Some of them ended up in jail. They lost a public job. So like these are where people, they lost their homes, they lost their families. Some of them committed suicide. It was all taken to court sometime after, and the audit that was ordered by the court found out that the accuracy, the reliability of the system was the same as flipping a coin. So basically we had been telling people that they were criminals like this, like, you know, I don't like your face, I don't like whatever, and just I'm just going to ruin your life for nothing, disguised under this really sophisticated, better than humans AI system. Like, we need mechanisms to ensure that really crappy systems don't end up in the market, that no one can buy a system that does that.
I mean, I think we need you on every on every AI system that's going out, because I think in so many ways we do position AI as being smarter than us and all of these things, and in many ways it can compute faster and do a lot of cool things that we use daily. But it sounds like you're suggesting like that human judgment still needs to be a huge part of this.
It's more than a human judgment. Like, we need to understand how decisions are being made. Mm-hmm. And if we don't, and it's not a decision that can be made by engineers alone. And I think that's one of the main mistakes that I see, that we've kind of trusted AI development to engineers. And I don't think you can code for a world that you don't understand. And that doesn't mean that engineers are dumb. It just means that engineers are not trained for this. It's like, you know, you may be a plumber and you may be the best plumber, that you cannot build a building on your own. You know, you can, that doesn't mean that you're worse of a plumber. You can be a fantastic plumber, the best plumber ever. But unless you know how to talk to the electrician and the painter and the architect and all the others, you will not be doing your job well. And I think that we've put like these plumbers, engineers in this space, just surrounded by people like them, thinking that they don't need anyone else. And when it comes to building complex buildings like complex AI, they just don't have the tools to assess mm-hmm. risks and to address those risks in a proactive manner. So that at Etikas, that's what we do. Like, we're your external team that comes in and tells you these are the things that you cannot see because you haven't been trained to do that. And so now go back to your system and optimize it for the metrics that we're sharing with you, because these are metrics that also need to be part of your system. It's like, in a way, like, I think most people are familiar with clinical trials in medicine. Yep. Like, you know, if you have a team of biologists innovating around COVID, for instance, you have lots of different phases and you can have success in the lab, success with animals, but there's a final testing part, which is clinical trials, where humans are involved. And that's not a compliance mechanism. That's actually part of the research. Like, you know, in clinical trials, you realize some of the secondary effects. You need to go back to the lab and change some things. So it's not a compliance, like, oh, just, you know, verify that what I'm doing is correct. It's actually part of the research. So what we do at Etikas when we audit AI systems, we add this layer of clinical trials. It's like engineers have visibility over lab results, but there's all this set of other results of what happens when systems work in the wild, what happens when systems interact with actual people, with actual Black women who want to have a natural birth, or people with a heart attack who want to be seen at a hospital, or with people who apply for a job and are a perfect candidate, but just because they're not the pattern identified by AI, they're being left out. And that's what we can see through our platform and software and methods, and then give that data back to engineers. We're like, listen, you don't have to get a PhD on quantitative social science. You just need to understand that these are your parameters. Just make sure that you fix your system and that you perform in the boundaries that we give you.
Well, I just love this idea that we're saying, hey, you might be creating some XYZ medication that's for, you know, 1 million people potentially in this country, and you've done 7 clinical trials and all these things before. Because we think, hey, it might hurt someone. It could hurt someone. There's a risk. It might kill them. There's a risk. But now you're rolling out this thing called AI, which actually might affect people in a way so much that you've already noted, to a point where people can take their lives because of the consequences. It might hurt people. It might cause the lack of human rights. It might harm them. And guess what? I think we should probably test this first. Like, it seems so obvious when you say it, but why isn't it happening? Like, why do you think it's not happening?
Because I think we've allowed the tech industry to claim that they don't need regulation, that they know better. And I don't think they do. Like, again, they're just plumbers. They're great plumbers, but they're just plumbers. If they want to get into the business of building buildings, they need to do better, and they need to learn to talk to other people. And I think we've kind of turned them into demigods, you know, and we do kind of assume that tech is magic. It's not magic. It's just, it's really just numbers. It's really just patterns and mass data. Like, there's nothing magic in what we see when we audit. And I think that we've created a myth around AI that means that often the way we talk about AI, I think, says more about us as a society than about technology. and that's problematic, because I think that then we create these myths when we're not actually discussing technological possibilities and technological risks, but we are discussing science fiction. And so we have most people discussing science fiction when no one's actually looking at what does this do? There's just not enough people doing that and testing systems. And again, and everyone goes back to engineers and be like, oh, what's the solution? And they don't know. Like, again, they don't have
the training. Why would they know? They don't know study anthropology and sociology.
Exactly.
Politics and leadership.
You go to a plumber and you're like, oh, now can you get all the permits from the city hall or whatever? And like, that's not my trade, you know, and it's fine. Yeah, you don't need to know about everything. You just need to make sure that someone on your team does.
Yes. Whenever you speak, I always think of this emoji. Do you know this one?
No.
It's like
it's
like bow down. That's how I see it. Like,
I like
preach a little, you know? And it's funny because when I was thinking about among other things, I have different segments in the podcast that are usually a bit more fun. And so, like, when you're speaking, I was thinking about this, and I was thinking about how, one of the segments that I do is called overthinking. And there's different ones on each podcast, but I wanted to do this one with you, which is where we dive deep into a seemingly simple or trivial aspect of the episode's theme and analyze it to an amusing extent. Playful over analysis. And usually it highlights the nuance of kind of everyday things. And so, of course, when I was thinking about it, I started thinking about, well, how do everyday people interact with these things? And I was reading a story, of course, about, I think it's actually an older story now, but it was about emojis. And this is why I put this one in there. And it was about how like representation and the visual language of emojis is actually what it was about. Like, can we do more communication with emojis? But this is why this is under overthinking, because emojis is one of those things where I was like, we use this every single day. Everyone uses it. And I don't know if everyone knows how emojis are recommended to them, how they're created. And so let's just start anywhere. First off, what comes to mind?
Well, actually, the history of emojis is really, really, really interesting. And there's been a lot of iteration as to how to make sure that emojis are useful, but also representative. Not only in terms of, you know, the color of your skin, but also in terms of how you express emotion. So I think it's a fascinating field. Like, I remember when I went to China to do some work on AI ethics with the government there. And it was really surprising to me that with Chinese people, we don't share a language, obviously, but we don't share facial expressions. And that made everything so difficult. Like, even yes and no are different. So like, you're trying to communicate, like, and if you don't speak a language, you try to communicate with gestures. That was useless. Like, it was we didn't know what we were saying. And you realize how gestures are important to communication, and how communicating is not only about saying words, but there's a lot more around it. And that's what we see when we see the typed word. It's like, that's not communicating. There's so much, or it's not communicating the same way that you would do it in the real world, or in the face-to-face scenario, or now that we can see each other's face and hear the intonation and see the gestures. And so the written word has had to incorporate ways to share, to transmit that emotion that words on a paper alone may not be able to transmit or to convey. And I think that's so interesting, because oftentimes we're like, oh, just, you know, speaking and writing are the same thing. But actually, the way that we receive something that is said by a human being that comes with a lot more cues, and something that we read, is completely different. And that's the same thing that happens with AI. It's like, we often think, oh, you know, AI makes decisions, so AI is like a mini human. No, the way AI makes decisions is completely different. And so we need to constantly compensate for all the things that are missing in the way that AI makes decisions to ensure that it resembles what a human would do, because it's completely different.
Is there any part of emoji language use that AI is connected to?
Oh, totally. And AI learns about the emotions. There's a lot of analysis on how you feel based on the emojis that you use. So of course, that also gives the providers insight into how you feel. So when engineers do emotion recognition in like how you feel about a brand or a shop, that's one of the things that the natural language processing systems and models capture. To capture that sentiment. Because again, you know, words, like the same word can mean so many different things in different contexts that unless you have that other aspect, it's basically an emoji is like language. It's a way to communicate. Mm-hmm. And so it has meaning in its own. So it's read by AI in the same way that language is.
And you can see how that could get really dicey really quickly if you're talking about different cultures than where a similar gesture means something different. Because I remember there's like one where I think the person is doing this, like putting their head on the table, but it's called bow. And I'm like, how is this taking a bow? Like, this doesn't look like a bow to me. So I think the AI thinks I take a lot of bows.
No, like for the longest time, maybe it already exists now, but I use that all the time. Like, I needed an emoji for a hug. Like, you know, when someone was saying, and like, I want to hug you. And there's this one that goes like this, which is not a hug at all. But I'm like, it's the closest thing. Like, I would do it like this, but I literally like
yeah.
this. So like, you like find your ways. You find ways. Or I remember my sister, when she's super happy, she sends you a whale. For her, a whale is like the, you know, the image of happiness. It's like, that's yeah. how she communicates. And we create language and communication and emotion through that, which I think it's fantastic.
And then she just like can't figure out later why she's getting all these whale advertisements. Like, do you want to go whale watching?
No, and she may regret telling me that, because now whenever I need to give some, I thought that was so amazing. Like, I love that so much. And now when I see a whale with a tail up, I'm also like, that's a really happy whale. So I keep getting her gifts with whales. So she may totally regret telling me that, because now she's stuck in whale land.
Yeah, she's stuck in whale land for sure. We have a lot of whales around this house too, because for the most random reason, my husband, one of his earlier businesses was a marketing agency, and it was called Splash Effect. And their little like icon, what do you call it, mascot was a whale. And so then everyone, like your sister, everyone bought him everything they saw that had whales on it. And I was just like, so now I just have a bunch of random whale stuff in my house too.
We also have whales here, because my husband's from Northern Spain. I'm from Barcelona, but my husband's from Northern Spain, which is a very like, it's a part of the country that is very much related to the beach, the sea, sailors stuff. So when we moved here, we brought some stuff related to that. And the idea of blue and fish reminds me of home. So we also have whales for other reasons. I think whales are amazing.
I mean, if we were going to overthink something tonight unexpected, it could be how amazing whales are. Like,
yes.
Those creatures are outworldly. Have you seen the documentary that James Cameron did? I think it's called The Secret of Whales. And in order to prove that he could use his underwater technology to make Avatar 2, he did a National Geographic doc series called The Secrets of Whales, and you are gonna love it, and everyone listening is gonna love it.
Wow, I didn't know that. Like, if there was a study on like, is there anyone who changes the channel or turns off the TV when someone's talking about whales? I'm sure that the statistics would prove that we as humans are drawn to whales.
I think anyone who changes the channel is not well.
Totally. Like, we're just wrong. Like, yeah, from Moby Dick. Like, I think there's, we build so much around whales and the relationship to humans. I think they mean a lot to us.
Well, honestly, we really could overthink this, because one of the things I'm most obsessed with whales is that they present all of the signs that you need in order to deem a community a culture. There's the four C's, which I'm going to forget right now, but it's like communication, collaboration, and traditions, like something like patterns that repeat. And so basically what we're saying, all you lovely listeners, is that Dr. Gemma and I are big whale fans.
Totally.
Okay, back to business. Away after that commercial break, no big deal. What do you see as the most pressing ethical issues in AI today? And like, why should average people care? Because it's so easy for us to understand them, but people listening could have not even realized that this is in their daily life.
So I was mentioning at the beginning how my work when I came here was around algorithmic justice. And I think that's such an important notion. What I see happening all the time is that through very complex technical procedures and means, we are undermining some really well-established fundamental rights that we all need to thrive in this society, unless you have a lot of money and don't need anyone else. But most of us need, you know, a public education system and access to healthcare and access to the pursuit of happiness, you know. And all of that is undermined when you don't have access to rights. And what I see in my work over and over again is how when a technical system intervenes, because the people that design the technical system are not aware of how all these rights underpin who we are and how society functions, they forget, or no one tells them to incorporate those rights. The idea of not discrimination, like, you know, you may have only hired white men in the past, But that doesn't mean that's right. And that doesn't mean that by hiring only right. white men in the future, you're going to be making the best decisions. But again, with this simple idea that the pattern is the most, the best choice, we are just forgetting so many other other things. So like, how do we make sure that the existing laws around non-discrimination are also incorporated in that? Also, how do we make sure that anything that hits the market protects us as citizens mm-hmm. and users? And I think that's a really crucial point. Like, democracies are about protection. We create yeah. democracies because we want to make sure that we all have similar chances and that living in societies is not dangerous. And so when you buy an apartment, like I did today, mm. you get all this paperwork that protects your rights. And when the building was built, there's all this paperwork they had to go through to ensure that the building doesn't fall on people. And, you know, there's a lot of people that don't believe in regulation, but like, but you still, you know, when you buy an apartment, you want your paperwork. That's regulation. That we're both yeah. sitting in chairs right now. These chairs yeah. to be sold have had to prove that they can hold the weight of a, of mm. the average human. Like, simple things like this have had to prove that they do not harm people. Mm-hmm. And that's the case in everything around us except technology. We allow for technology to go from idea in a lab to actual social impact. And then only down the line, we realize that we are creating addiction in young people, mm-hmm. that we are worsening mental health issues, that we are worsening instances of misinformation, that we are spreading lies about people, that we are making people more vulnerable.
Yeah.
We should have tested for that beforehand. We should have known better than to release that in the population. It's like in the 19th century, you could buy cocaine at pharmacies because we didn't have an ecosystem of protection. Oh, wow. Today you can.
Really?
Because yes. yes. Because there's wow, mechanisms we that ensure that you need to before you get to the pharmacy, you need to prove that you're not gonna harm people. And that the way that you interact with the human body, if you are medicine or cocaine, is something mm-hmm. that you can be accountable for, except for tech. So I think that tech right now is in a very abnormal situation in a democratic society. And I think that we need to do better at protecting ourselves and others. I think that more and more of the people listening to us are going to find how decisions about them are being made by AI. Performance at work is being assessed more and more by AI indicators. We should know what those indicators are. And we should have the ability to say, I don't think that those indicators represent me. There was a journalist in the New York Times that did an exercise. He downloaded some performance software and shared it with the editor. I was like, let's try this. Like, let's see if that right. it's useful for me in terms of my productivity, and let's see if it's useful for you. And then what he found is that the system was only recording the time he spent typing. And it was like, but so much about my work is about thinking. Like, I stay up all night thinking about my pieces or making phone yeah. calls and finding things out. The system could not have indicators for that because it did not have access to that information. And so he found it really frustrating that he was being judged on something that was not a good proxy for yeah. his performance. And the manager felt the same way. I'm like, I'm getting all this data about things that I don't care about. Like, I'm like, is your piece good? that's all I care about. Like, how you get there, I'm that's not an indicator of performance to me. And when we audit systems, we often find that someone's decided, oh, an indicator of performance is how long you spend on the computer. And both the employee and the employer
have to decide.
That's exactly that. That's not useful to me. And so we need to make sure that we know what those indicators are. And when we feel that we should be using other indicators, have a space to say that. Right now, redress mechanisms don't really exist in AI. That's why the postal workers ended up committing suicide. They had no way to say this is right. wrong, because we just keep assuming that AI is better than us, and we cannot contradict an AI verdict. Well, when actually AI makes lots and lots of mistakes, and it only takes to look at what the indicators are to see whether that's a good decision or not. We need more transparency around those systems to make sure that people are protected.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you could go on forever. And when I was thinking of a thought experiment about what we could think through, the first thing that I often hear from regular folks when they're talking about AI is always worried about their jobs and automation and what's going to come from that. But I also know that we know the good side of AI too, and we know the good side of how it can improve people's jobs. And so I was hoping that we could dive into a thought experiment now on this train. And These thought experiments allow for some exploration of different ideas without the consequences or constraints of reality. And for this one, I called it the Automation Insight Experiment, where we're going to go through five common jobs that are maybe not so obvious. And then our whole task is to think through how they could be automated with technology. But this does not necessarily mean automated out of existence. Mm-hmm. It just means, you know, maybe one part of it even could be automated or improved with AI to make their jobs easier. So I chose five that are common jobs in North America, but that it might not be as obvious to people. So are you ready?
I am.
Okay. The first one is what is deemed to be the most common job in the US is food preparation worker or kitchen staff?
No. No risk of AI. There's risk of robotics, but that's a different thing. Robotics as in hardware, like machines that can pick up things. They don't need to think.
Oh, so like is that under automation?
Yes. But it's hardware. Like the software is not that crucial. It's more like the ability to move. Like we have a lot of this kind of technology in making cars. When you have to lift something really heavy, we don't use humans anymore. We use machines.
Yeah.
So these are machines that know, you know, it's just a mechanic exercise. So you're automating a gesture, so to speak. And so that there's no intelligence or the machine doesn't have to think or react to anything because it's just doing that. So I don't foresee, like, even though we could imagine a factory where everything was completely automated, in my experience, workers are a lot cheaper and more reliable than those machines. And so what often happens is that we may have technology that is better in terms of like maybe being stronger or not falling ill, but when humans are cheap, then automation is a lot more like slower to be incorporated. So like you see a lot more automation of these kind of tasks in Germany, where staff is expensive, and a lot less in countries in Southern Europe or in India, where people working is actually cheap. And also with the human, you get the added value of the ability to respond to the unexpected, which is something that a machine on hardware or software will never be able to do.
So then, okay, so for then food preparation worker, we've got potentially, if it was maybe in fast food, there's some automation risk, but not while humans are cheaper.
Exactly.
Okay, good insight. Now, the next
just think about the complexity. Like if you have to identify that an apple is rotten, this takes a human no time whatsoever.
Right.
To train an AI system to identify that an apple is rotten, it takes a lot of compute, and the error rates are very high. So again, can we get a machine to do it? Yes, but better than a human? No. So, you know, if you want you want reliability on the decisions, you might as well just rely on a human. So like, again, because we... machines and AI don't think like humans. It's a completely different process. Like if you show a child a cat once when they're like two, they will be able to identify any cat for the rest of their life in any position at any distance. We want an AI to identify a cat. We need to feed it with millions of images of cats, and still the error rates are going to be super, super high. I mean, we've had instances of AI systems being trained on lots of images of humans and then still saying that gorillas were black people. So like the error rates are very, very, very high. The idea of identifying patterns doesn't allow AI to be as good as we are at this abstract thinking. And so again, can an AI identify a rotten apple? Maybe, but then you're going to spend a lot of money training the system on apples, and then one day you're going to have potatoes, and then you have to start all over again. When a human will come, and on the first day you can say, if anything's rotten, you don't let it go through, and the human will be able to implement it immediately at zero cost.
Now, the next one is a teacher. AI and automation, could they improve it? Will it harm it? What's going to happen here?
I think it's going to change it. And I think it's really important that we walk away from this idea of AI substituting humans.
Okay, AI, cool. I'm down with that.
AI incorporates and is useful in specific tasks. And that can mean that we need less people for specific jobs, but the jobs don't disappear. It's just that maybe we need less people because they're assisted by these systems. There's lots of different levels. The act of teaching cannot be, like, the human act of teaching cannot be substituted by AI. Transmitting information about a subject can be done by AI, but teaching is way more than that. Teaching is about, and it depends on the age, but it's about, you know, forming you as a person, shaping you as a person, shaping your values, helping you be a human being and relating to others and developing your social skills. There's no way that an AI system can do that. However, can it help teachers if they're doing multiple choice exams rate faster? Definitely. So basically, like, anything for which you have massive historical data and the information comes in very structured ways, like a multiple choice text, you can automate that in no time. If you don't have that massive data from the past, like, if there's a new thing, a new phenomena, forget about AI. AI is not your friend. There's nothing it can do unless it's been trained on past data. But also, the past data needs to be very structured. So one of the things that happened that is Cathy O'Neill, who's like the mother of AI auditing, in her amazing book, Weapons of Math Destruction, she talks about how several states in the US started to use AI to assess the performance of teachers. And these systems were supposed to be much better than humans at identifying whether someone was a good teacher. But again, some teachers felt that after AI was incorporated, their performance had been deemed like negative, when before there was no problem with their performance. So some of them took the system to court. And when the system was audited, it was found that it was assessing the performance of teachers in the secondary education based on the grades of students in math and language, which is it's a reduction of what it means to teach. And we see that a lot in AI systems. AI systems tend to simplify complex processes to a level that turns them into a caricature. Like, you know, any teacher would feel insulted by the idea that their job is only about the grades of students in math and language. But also, what kind of incentives are we creating for those teachers? Then they know, listen, if I want to stay at this job and even like get a bonus, an increase, whatever, all I need to do is make sure that my students get good grades in math and language. And regardless of whether they're going through a hard, So, you know, we are making teaching worse because we are creating these incentives. So I think that we need to understand what building indicators and making decisions on those indicators does to the people that produce those indicators. So the idea of, you know, AI always works on indicators, on data that is an indicator of something. We need to know what those indicators are because they're not always the best.
Mm-hmm. Now, the next one is construction worker. How could automation or AI play a role here?
Lifting weights, automation can help you with that. Also, like, construction workers could have access to better rendering of what they have to do. Like, it's easier to, compute data on what needs to be done. The composition, like, you need to make cement or whatever, mix different things. Access to knowledge as well. The identification, like, you can take a picture of something and can do, like, an automatic identification of something. There's also thermal imaging that can tell you, like, what's behind the wall. So there's lots of, like, little technological improvements that can help construction workers do their jobs better. But I don't think we'll need less construction workers or that the trade is going to change significantly. Mm-hmm. I think if that happens, it's going to be because of innovation in materials, not necessarily in AI.
Oh, that's interesting, though. I like that you were saying, like, hey, this could actually help you in a lot of ways, too.
Totally.
Okay. The fourth one, and then we have one last one real quick, is fourth one is police officer.
Oh, well, there's been so much controversy around this. So the police were one of the first professions to use AI was the police. Actually, I come from that field. I used to train police AI technology and data. And the police were one of the first professions to use big data to identify crime patterns. And it was really interesting because one of the classic examples of what data allowed them to do was there was a case, I think it was Chicago, and I did that a long time ago, so I don't use those examples anymore. But they were having, so like on Wednesdays, there was a lot of crime in an area that was not an area where people with criminal backgrounds lived or where things happen other than on those dates. And so, and the police officers individually couldn't work out what was happening, why Wednesdays, why there was so much crime in that area. And then when they put the data, they collected the data, like, you know, what are the crimes happening? Who is doing those crimes? Where do these people come from? They put it on a map using computers. And they realized that that point was on the way between a very problematic neighborhood in a place that catered for people that were drug dependent. And so and Wednesday was the day where methadone was being given. And so you had a lot of people getting out of their normal patterns of mobility in that city to go to get that methadone. And then in the process, they were committing crimes. And this was only became obvious once it was put on a map and you had aggregated data from all the different districts that showed that. And so we say AI now, but a few years ago, we said big data is actually very, very similar. True. It's like the power of data, having information, masses of information that allows us to see things differently. And so in the police, we've had a lot of data-led innovation in the last few years, even the fact that there were the body-worn cams, the ability to try to predict crime, where crime is going to happen, where to deploy police officers. But again, it's very problematic because I guess many people are familiar with Minority Report. Like, should we even predict crime? If you have not committed a crime, should you be punished for something that you haven't committed? And I think that the police forces all over the world are very much strapped in this idea. We have tools that can tell us who's more likely, but being more likely doesn't mean that you will do something. But also we're finding as well that when we do this exercise in putting all the data, we see, okay, so there's in this neighborhood, there's more people who are criminals. There's more people that are committing crimes. And so the temptation is to deploy more cops in that area. But then what we see is that the first victims of criminality are the neighbors of those criminals. And if we just deploy more people in that space, we're actually victimizing them twice, because then the value of their homes goes down because it's seen as a neighborhood where no one wants to go to. So how do we protect the first victims of those criminals without turning them into victims for other reasons of the neighbors that they have? So it's just, again, it's so complicated. We have all this data, but we need to know how to manage that data, because oftentimes the initial conclusion just does more harm than good.
And finally, these are great. How will AI or automation help or hinder you and I as CEOs? How will it help or hinder the CEO?
I think, data can help us make better decisions, know more about how our teams work, be able to track things. But we need to be very aware that we're only measuring what is measurable. And a lot of things are not measurable. But luckily, I think that AI also can bring about an era of new transparency and new accountability. So because we have a lot of data, we know that only 2% of VC funds go to women. So, you know, and now we have that aggregated data. 10 years ago, we didn't have the information. So by gathering this information, we're also able to expose dynamics that we want to change. So I think that it can help us both in our day-to-day work with our teams, also allowing us when we do Zoom calls, having AI summarize things, also helping our teams get better. Like, listen, ChatGPT is like the baseline. You need to be better than ChatGPT. Like, you know, in the past, you have an intern. It's like, you know, this is just like a high school essay. That's not acceptable. Now it's like, the baseline is ChatGPT. If you perform as ChatGPT, you're not adding value as a human being. It's like, I'm going to demand that you perform much better than ChatGPT, and also challenging our staff. And like, you know, that's what ChatGPT says. Mm-hmm. Why do we like it? Why do we not like it? Or like, why do we want to think different? Why do we want to innovate around this? So I think there's a lot of potential. I mean, I use data and AI all the time to make better decisions, but I also think it will help us quantify as women CEOs dynamics that need to be changed and just use those numbers to go to the people responsible for those inequalities and telling them this is urgent and necessary.
You're getting another emoji. another raise hands.
You're getting a hug.
Okay, Jim. You know, as we're getting here to the end, I always end off with a segment called Train of Thought, where we connect the theme of our conversation to the theme of the last episode. So what would you say is the theme of our conversation tonight?
Oh, women trying to build a better world.
Women trying to build a better world, maybe with AI.
Mm-hmm.
I think that was a theme for sure. Okay, so then the theme of the last one that you have to connect this somehow. My last guest said he believed the theme of our conversation was that we all had to cognitively reframe education and to see its future possibilities. We had to cognitively reframe education to see future possibilities. And as a side note, that conversation did also center largely around AI. So it's funny that you're back to back. But how would we connect this idea of cognitively reframing education and seeing its future possibilities to women building businesses with AI to make the world better?
I should say. I like the complexity of what the other person said, and I challenge not only the person who was in your last show, but also anyone listening to us right now to try to think. So, what are the indicators of that? If we were to do that with AI, how would we do it? And I bet that they will give up. Because when it comes to complex thinking, when we need to use our creativity and our experience and not just gather data and identify patterns, AI is not a friend. And so when the stakes are high, when the challenges are important, we do need the ability of humans to think outside of the box. AI will never think outside of the box because AI is being made to be boxed in the data that it's been trained in. So I think that I love that complexity, and I love how it challenges us as humans to think. And I think there's this temptation with AI that, you know, we don't need to think. AI can do that for us. And it really can't. AI can only gather data, identify patterns, and tell us what the majority pattern is. That is not thinking. That's something else. Can be super useful in specific contexts, but that's not thinking. That's not solving the crucial issues of humanity right now.
Mm-hmm. And so then how do we take that and connect it to reframing education in our minds to see the possibilities here in this space?
Well, I think we just need to think about what education is. Is education just transmitting knowledge? Like, it's our teachers just like, you know, encyclopedias with legs that just go through words and definitions. If we want to understand education as a complex process, I think we need to determine, what do we want to teach? What do we want to educate on? And I think that's what shaping the future is about. There's so many challenges that we have as human beings. I think that one of the challenges that we have is to make sure that we get AI right. But there's lots of other things, lots of other challenges, lots of other spaces of innovation. And I fear sometimes that because we're talking about AI all the time, all the innovation and all the work and the effort that other people are making in other fields, with or without AI, are completely being obscured. Like, we have many, 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 many challenges. For some of them, AI will be our friend. For some of them, AI will be completely irrelevant. Regardless of the role of AI, let's make sure that we move forward on that. So what does it mean to educate? What are the complexities of educating in a connected world where access to information and to bad information is so, so easy, when the inputs that kids receive are so complex and come from so many different places? What is the role of being a parent or being a teacher when the inputs that kids receive are so, so many and so non-controlled inputs as well? Like, I think that we need to reimagine what it means to build your character in a fast changing world where the last thing we have is control.
And we ourselves are those, you know, those women changing the world with AI and quite literally educators making those future possibilities. And on that note, is there any last kind of thoughts or piece of advice that you want to give listeners before we go?
Oh, no, I just want to thank you for this space. Like, it's been great. Noah, you've given me like a lot of space to talk. I hope that listeners got something out of it. I hope that I inspired some of them to get into responsible AI, to think more critically about all these issues. But my last thought is a thought of gratitude. Thank you so much for putting this together.
Well, thank you very much. And thank you all for listening. We'll be right back.